This is Audible.
Debt of Honor by Tom Clancy. This book is read by John MacDonald. A man's character is his fate. Heraclitus. Prologue. Sunset, sunrise. In retrospect, it would seem an odd way to start a war. Only one of the participants knew what was really happening, and even that was a coincidence. The property settlement had been moved up on the calendar due to a death in the attorney's family, and so the attorney was scheduled for a red-eye flight 2 hours from now to Hawaii. It was Mr. Yamada's first property closing on American soil, though he owned many properties in the continental United States. The actual title transfer had always been handled by other attorneys, invariably American citizens who had done precisely what they'd been paid to do, generally with oversight by one of Mr. Yamada's employees. But not this time. There were several reasons for it. One was that the purchase was personal and not corporate. Another was that it was close, only 2 hours by private jet from his home. Mr. Yamada had told the settlement attorney that the property would be used for a weekend getaway house. With the astronomical price of real estate in Tokyo, he could buy several hundred acres for the price of a modestly large penthouse apartment in his city of residence. The view from the house he planned to build on the promontory would be breathtaking. A vista of the blue Pacific, other islands of the Marianas Archipelago in the distance, air as clean as any on the face of the earth. For all those reasons, Mr. Yamada had offered a princely fee, and done so with a charming smile. And for one reason more. The various documents slid clockwise around the circular table, stopping at each chair so that signatures could be affixed at the proper place, marked with yellow post-it notes. And then it was time for Mr. Yamada to reach into his coat pocket and withdraw an envelope. He took out the check and handed it to the attorney. "Thank you, sir," the lawyer said in a respectful voice, as Americans always did when money was on the table. It was remarkable how money made them do anything. Until 3 years before, the purchase of land here by a Japanese citizen would have been illegal. But the right lawyer and the right case and the right amount of money had fixed that, too. The title transfer will be recorded this afternoon. Yamada looked at the seller with a polite smile and a nod, then he rose and left the building. A car was waiting outside. Yamada got in the front passenger seat and motioned peremptorily for the driver to head off. The settlement was complete and with it the need for charm. Like most Pacific islands, Saipan is of volcanic origin. Immediately to the east is the Marianas Trench, a chasm fully 7 miles deep where one geological plate dives under another. The result is a collection of towering cone-shaped mountains, of which the islands themselves are merely the tips. The Toyota Land Cruiser followed a moderately smooth road north, winding around Mount Achugao and the Mariana Country Club toward Marpi Point. There it stopped. Yamada alighted from the vehicle, his gaze resting on some farm structures that would soon be erased. But instead of walking to the building site for his new house, he headed toward the rocky edge of the cliff. Though a man in his early 60s, his stride was strong and purposeful as he moved across the uneven field. If it had been a farm, then it had been a poor one, he saw, inhospitable to life, as this place had been more than once, and from more than one cause. His face was impassive as he reached the edge of what the locals called Banzai Cliff. An onshore wind was blowing, and he could see and hear the waves marching in their endless ranks to smash against the rocks at the base of the cliff, the same rocks that had smashed the bodies of his parents and siblings after they and so many others had jumped off to evade capture by the advancing U.S. Marines. The sight had horrified the Marines, but Mr. Yamada would never appreciate or acknowledge that. The businessman clapped his hands once and bowed his head, both to call the attention of the lingering spirits to his presence and to show proper obeisance to their influence over his destiny. It was fitting, he thought, that his purchase of this parcel of land now meant that 50.016% of the real estate on Saipan was again in Japanese hands, more than 50 years since his family's death at American hands. He felt a sudden chill and ascribed it to the emotion of the moment, or perhaps the nearness of his ancestors' spirits. Though their bodies had been swept away in the endless surf, surely their kami had never left this place and awaited his return. He shuddered and buttoned his coat. Yes, he'd build here, but only after he'd done what was necessary first. First, he had to destroy. It was one of those perfect moments half a world away. The driver came smoothly back away from the ball in a perfect arc, stopped for the briefest of moments, then accelerated back along the same path, downward now, gaining speed as it fell. The man holding the club shifted his weight from one leg to the other. At the proper moment, his hands turned over as they should, which caused the club head to rotate around the vertical axis, so that when the head hit the ball, it was exactly perpendicular to the intended flight path. The sound told the tale. A perfect tink. It was a metal-headed driver. That and the tactile impulse transmitted through the graphite shaft told the golfer everything he needed to know. He didn't even have to look. The club finished its follow-through path before the man's head turned to track the flight of the ball. Unfortunately, Ryan wasn't the one holding the club. Jack shook his head with a rueful grin as he bent to tee up his ball. Nice hit, Robbie. Rear Admiral, lower half, Robert Jefferson Jackson, USN, held his pose, his aviator's eyes watching the ball start its descent, then bounce on the fairway about 250 yards away. The bounces carried it another 30 or so. He didn't speak until it stopped dead center. I meant to draw it a little. Life's a bitch, ain't it? Ryan observed as he went through his setup ritual. Knees bent, back fairly straight, head down, but not too much. The grip. Yes, that's about right. He did everything the club pro had told him the previous week and the week before that, and the week bringing the club back and down. And it wasn't too bad. Just off the fairway to the right, 180 yards, the best first tee drive he'd hit in forever. And approximately the same distance with his driver that Robbie would have gotten with a firm 7-iron. About the only good news was that it was only 7:45 a.m. and there was nobody around to share his embarrassment. At least you cleared the water. Been playing long, Jack? 2 whole months. Jackson grinned as he headed down to where the cart was parked. I started my second year at Annapolis. I have a head start, boy. Hell, enjoy the day. There was that. The Greenbrier is set among the mountains of West Virginia, a retreat that dates back to the late 18th century. On this October morning, the white mass of the main hotel building was framed with yellows and scarlets as the hardwood trees enter their yearly cycle of autumn fire. "Well, I don't expect to beat you," Ryan allowed as he sat down in the cart. A turn, a grin. "You won't. Just thank God you're not working today, Jack." "I am." Neither man was in the vacation business as much as each needed it, nor was either man currently satisfied with success. For Robbie, it meant a flag desk in the Pentagon. For Ryan, much to his surprise even now, it had been a return to the business world instead of the academic slot that he'd wanted, or at least thought he'd wanted, standing there in Saudi Arabia 2.5 years before. Perhaps it was the action, he thought. Had he become addicted to it? Jack asked himself, selecting a 3-iron. It wouldn't be enough club to make the green, but he hadn't learned fairway woods yet. Yeah, it was the action he craved, even more than his occasional escape from it. Take your time and don't try to kill it. The bull's already dead, okay? Yes, sir, Admiral, sir, Jack replied. Keep your head down. I'll do the watching. All right, Robbie. The knowledge that Robbie would not laugh at him, no matter how bad the shot, was somehow worse than the suspicion that he might. On last reflection, he stood a little straighter before swinging. His reward was a welcome sound. Swat! The ball was 30 yards away before his head came up to see it, still heading left, but already showing a fade back to the right. Jack? Yeah, Ryan answered without turning his head. You're 3-iron, Jackson said, chuckling, his eyes computing the flight path. Don't change anything. Do it just like that every time. Somehow Jack managed to put his iron back in the bag without trying to wrap the shaft around his friend's head. He started laughing when the cart moved again up the right side rough toward Robbie's bowl, the single white spot on the green, even carpet. Miss flying? He asked gently. Robbie looked at him. You played dirty, too, he observed, but that was just the way things went. He'd finished his last flying job, screened for flag, then been considered for the post of commander of the Naval Aviation Test Center at Naval Air Station Patuxent River, Maryland, where his real title would have been Chief Test Pilot, U.S. Navy. But instead, Jackson was working in J-3, the Operations Directorate for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. War plans, an odd slot for a warrior in a world where war was becoming a thing of the past. It was more career-enhancing, but far less satisfying than the flying billet he'd really wanted. Jackson tried to shrug it off. He'd done his flying, after all. He'd started in Phantoms and graduated to Tomcats, commanded his squadron and a carrier air wing, then screened early for flag rank on the basis of a solid and distinguished career, during which he'd never put a foot wrong. His next job, if he got it, would be as commander of a carrier battle group, something that had once seemed to him a goal beyond the grasp of fortune itself. Now that he was there, he wondered where all the time had gone and what lay ahead. What happens when we get old? Some of us take up golf, Rob. Or go back to stocks and bonds, Jackson countered. An 8-iron, he thought, a soft one. Ryan followed him to his bowl. Merchant banking, Jack proffered. It worked out for you, hasn't it? That made the aviator, active or not, Robbie would always be a pilot, to himself and his friends, look up and grin. Well, you turned my 100th thou into something special, Sir John. With that, he took his shot. It was one way to get even. The ball landed, bounced, and finally stopped about 20 feet from the pin. Enough to buy me lessons. You sure as hell need 'em. Robbie paused and allowed his face to change. A lot of years, Jack. We changed the world. And that was a good thing, wasn't it? After a fashion, Jack conceded with a tight smile. Some people called it an end to history, but Ryan's doctorate was in that field, and he had trouble with the thought. You really like it, what you're doing now? I'm home every night, usually before 6. I get to see all the Little League games in the summer and most of the soccer games in the fall, and when Sally's ready for her first date, I won't be in some goddamn BC-20B, halfway to nowhere for a meeting that doesn't mean much of anything anyway. Jack smiled in a most comfortable way. And I think I prefer that even to playing good golf. Well, that's a good thing, 'cause I don't even think Arnold Palmer can fix your swing. But I'll try, Robbie added, just because Kathy asked me to. Jack's pitch was too strong, forcing him to chip back out of the green, badly, where 3 putts carded him a 7 to Robbie's par 4. A golfer who plays like you should swear more, Jackson said on the way to the second tee. Ryan didn't have a chance for a rejoinder. He had a beeper on his belt, of course. It was a satellite beeper, the kind that could get you almost anywhere. Tunnels under mountains or bodies of water offered some protection, but not much. Jack plucked it off his belt. It was probably the silicon alchemy deal, he thought, even though he'd left instructions. Maybe someone had run out of paper clips. He looked at the number on the LCD display. "I thought your home office was New York," Robbie noted. The area code on the display was 202, not the 212 Jack had expected to see. "It is. I can teleconference most of my work out of Baltimore, but at least once a week I have to catch the Metroliner up there." Ryan frowned. 757-5000. The White House signals office. He checked his watch. It was 7:55 in the morning, and the time announced the urgency of the call more clearly than anything else could. It wasn't exactly a surprise, though, was it, he asked himself? Not with what he'd been reading in the papers every day. The only thing unexpected was the timing. He'd expected the call much sooner. He walked to the cart and the golf bag where he kept his cellular phone. It was the one thing in the bag, actually, that he knew how to use. It took only 3 minutes as an amused Robbie waited in the cart. Yes, he was at the Greenbrier. Yes, he knew that there was an airport not too far from there. 4 hours? Less than an hour out and back, no more than an hour at his destination, back in time for dinner. He'd even have time to finish his round of golf, shower, and change before he left, Jack told himself, folding the phone back up and dropping it in the pocket of the golf bag. That was one advantage of the world's best chauffeur service. The problem was that once they had you, they never liked to let go. The convenience of it was designed only to make it a more comfortable mode of confinement. Jack shook his head as he stood at the tee, and his distraction had a strange effect. The drive up the second fairway landed on the short grass 210 yards downrange, and Ryan walked back to the cart without a single word, wondering what he'd tell Kathy. The facility was brand new and spotless, but there was something obscene about it, the engineer thought. His countrymen hated fire, but they positively loathed the class of object that this room was designed to fabricate. He couldn't shake it off. It was like the buzz of an insect in the room, unlikely since every molecule of the air in this clean room had gone through the best filtration system his country could devise. His colleague's engineering excellence was a source of pride to this man, especially since he was among the best of them. It would be that pride that sustained him, he knew, dismissing the imaginary buzz as he inspected the fabrication machinery. After all, if the Americans could do it, and the Russians, and the English, and the French, and the Chinese, and even the Indians and Pakistanis, then why not them? There was a symmetry to it, after all. In another part of the building, the special material was being roughly shaped even now. Purchasing agents had spent quite some time acquiring the unique components. There were precious few. Most had been made elsewhere, but some had been made in his country for use abroad. They had been invented for one purpose, then adapted for others. But the possibility had always existed, distant but real, that the original application beckoned. It had become an institutional joke for the production people in the various corporations, something not to take seriously. But they'd take it seriously now, the engineer thought. He switched off the lights and pulled the door shut behind him. He had a deadline to meet, and he would start today after only a few hours of sleep. Even as often as he'd been here, Ryan had never lost his mystical appreciation for the place, and today's manner of arrival hadn't been contrived to make him look for the ordinary. A discreet call to his hotel had arranged for the drive to the airport. The aircraft had been waiting, of course, a twin-prop business bird sitting at the far end of the ramp, ordinary except for the USAF markings, and the fact that the flight crew had been dressed in olive-green Nomex. Friendly smiles again, of course, deferential. A sergeant to make sure he knew how to use the seatbelt and the perfunctory discussion of safety and emergency procedures. The look back from the pilot, who had a schedule to meet, and off they went with Ryan wondering where the briefing papers were and sipping a U.S. Air Force Coca-Cola, wishing he'd changed into his good suit and remembering that he had deliberately decided not to do so. Stupid, beneath himself. Flight time of 47 minutes and a direct approach into Andrews. The only thing they left out was the helicopter ride in from Andrews, but that would only have attracted attention. Met by a deferential Air Force major who'd walked him over to a cheap official car and a quiet driver, Ryan settled back in his seat and closed his eyes while the major took the front seat. He tried to nap. He'd seen Suitland Parkway before and knew the route by heart. Suitland Parkway to I-295, immediately off that and on to I-395, take the Main Avenue exit. The time of day, just after lunch, guaranteed rapid progress. And sure enough, the car stopped at the guard shack on West Executive Drive, where the guard most unusually just waved them through. The canopied entrance to the White House basement level beckoned, as did a familiar face. "Hi, Arnie." Jack held his hand out to the President's Chief of Staff. Arnold Van Damme was just too good, and Roger Durling had needed him to help with the transition. Soon enough, President Durling had measured his senior staffer against Arnie and found his own man wanting. He hadn't changed much, Ryan saw, the same L.L. Bean shirts and the same rough honesty on his face. But Arnie was older and tireder than before. Well, who wasn't? "The last time we talked here, you were kicking me loose," Jack said next, to get a quick read on the situation.
"We all make mistakes, Jack."
Uh-oh. Ryan went instantly on guard, but the handshake pulled him through the door anyway. The Secret Service agents on post had a pass all ready for him, and things went smoothly until he set off the metal detector. Ryan handed over his hotel room key and tried again, hearing yet another ping. The only other metal on his body, except for his watch, turned out to be his divot tool.
"When did you take up golf?" Van Damme asked, with a chuckle that matched the expression of the nearest agent. "Nice to know you haven't been following me around. 2 months, and I haven't broken 110 yet."
The chief of staff waved Ryan to the hidden stairs to the left.
"You know why they call it golf?"
"Yeah, because shit was already taken." Ryan stopped on the landing. "What gives, Arnie?"
"I think you know," was all the answer he got.
"Hello, Dr. Ryan." Special Agent Helen D'Agostino was as pretty as ever and still part of the presidential detail. "Please come with me." The presidency is not a job calculated to bring youth to a man. Roger Durling had once been a paratrooper who'd climbed hills in the Central Highlands of Vietnam. He was still a jogger and reportedly liked to play squash to keep fit, but for all that, he looked a weary man this afternoon. More to the point, Jack reflected quickly, he'd come straight in to see the president, no waiting in one of the many anterooms, and the smiles on the faces he'd seen on the way in carried a message of their own. Durling rose with a speed intended to show his pleasure at seeing his guest. Or maybe something else.
"How's the brokerage business, Jack?"
The handshake that accompanied the question was dry and hard, but with an urgency to it.
"It keeps me busy, Mr. President."
"Not too busy." "Golf in West Virginia?" Durling asked, waving Ryan to a seat by the fireplace. "That'll be all," he told the two Secret Service agents who'd followed Ryan in. "Thank you."
"My newest vice, sir," Ryan said, hearing the door close behind him.
It was unusual to be so close to the chief executive without the protective presence of Secret Service guards, especially since he had been so long out of government service. Durling took his seat and leaned back into it. His body language showed vigor, the kind that emanated from the mind rather than the body. It was time to talk business.
"I could say I'm sorry to interrupt your vacation, but I won't," the President of the United States told him.
You've had a 2-year vacation, Dr. Ryan. It's over now.
2 years. For the first 2 months of it, he'd done exactly nothing, pondered a few teaching posts in the sanctity of his study, watched his wife leave early every morning for her medical practice at Johns Hopkins, fixed the kids' school lunches, and told himself how wonderful it was to relax. It had taken those 2 months before he'd admitted to himself that the absence of activity was more stressful than anything he'd ever done. Only 3 interviews had landed him a job back in the investment business, enabled him to race his wife out of the house each morning and bitch about the pace, and just maybe prevent himself from going insane. Along the way, he'd made some money, but even that, he admitted to himself, had begun to pall. He still hadn't found his place, and wondered if he ever really would. "Mr. President, the draft ended a lot of years ago," Jack offered with a smile. It was a flippant observation, and one he was ashamed of, even as he said it. "You've said no to your country once." The rebuke put an end to the smiles. Was Durling that stressed out? Well, he had every right to be, and with the stress had come impatience, which was surprising in a man whose main function for the public was being pleasant and reassuring. But Ryan was not part of the public, was he?
"Sir, I was burned out then. I don't think I would have been..."
"Fine, I've seen your file, all of it," Durling added. "I even know that I might not be here now except for what you did down in Columbia a few years ago. You've served your country well, Dr. Ryan, and now you've had your time off and you've played the money game some more, rather well, it would seem, and now it's time to come back."
"What post, sir?" Jack asked.
"Down the hall and around the corner. The last few residents haven't distinguished themselves there," Durling noted. Cutter and Elliot had been bad enough. Durling's own national security advisor had simply not been up to the task. His name was Tom Locke, and he was on the way out, the morning paper had told Ryan. It would seem that the press had it right for once.
"I'm not going to beat around the bush. We need you. I need you."
"Mr. President, that's a very flattering statement, but the truth of the matter is..."
"The truth of the matter is that I have too much of a domestic agenda, and the day only has 24 hours, and my administration has fumbled the ball too many times. In the process, we've not served the country as well as we should have. I can't say that anywhere but inside this room, but I can and must say it here. State is weak. Defense is weak."
"Fiedler in Treasury is excellent," Ryan allowed. "And if you want advice about state, move Scott Adler up. He's young, but he's very good on process and pretty good on vision."
"Not without good oversight from this building, and I don't have the time for that. I will pass your approbation on to Buzz Fiedler," Durling added with a smile.
"He's a brilliant technician, and that's what you need across the street. If you're going to catch the inflation, for God's sake, do it now. And take the political heat," Durling said. "That's exactly what his orders are. Protect the dollar and hammer inflation down to zero. I think he can do it. The initial signs are promising." Ryan nodded. "I think you're right."
"Okay, get on with it."
Durling handed over the briefing book. "Read."
"Yes, sir."
Jack flipped open the binder's cover and kept flipping past the usual stiff pages that warned of all manner of legal sanctions for revealing what he was about to read. As usual, the information United States Code protected wasn't all that different from what any citizen could get in time, but it wasn't as well written. His right hand reached out for a coffee cup, annoyingly not the handleless mug he preferred. The White House china was long on elegance but short on practicality. Coming here was like visiting a particularly rich boss. So many of the appointments were just a little too... "I know about some of this, but I didn't know it was this interesting," Jack murmured.
"Interesting," Durling replied with an unseen smile. "That's a nice choice of words."
"Mary Pat's the deputy director of operations now." Ryan looked up to see the curt nod.
She was in here a month ago to plead her case for upgrading her side of the house. She was very persuasive. Al Trent just got the authorization through committee yesterday. Jack chuckled. Agriculture or interior this time? That part of CIA's budget was almost never in the open. The Directorate of Operations always got part of its funding through Leisure Domain. Health and Human Services, I think. But it'll still be 2 or 3 years before I know. Derling fidgeted in his seat.
Look, Jack, if it mattered to you that much, then why?
Sir, if you've read through my file, you know why. Dear God, Jack wanted to say, how much am I expected to? But he couldn't, not here, not to this man. And so he didn't. Instead, he went back into the briefing book, flipping pages, and read as rapidly as comprehension permitted.
I know it was a mistake to downplay the human intelligence side of the house. Trent and Fellows said so. Mrs. Foley said so. You can get overloaded in this office, Jack.
Ryan looked up and almost smiled until he saw the president's face. There was a tiredness around the eyes that Derling was unable to conceal. But then Derling saw the expression on Jack's own face.
"When can you start?" the President of the United States asked.
The engineer was back, flipping on the lights and looking at his machine tools. His supervisory office was almost all glass, and elevated slightly so that he could see all the activity in the shop with no more effort than a raised head. In a few minutes his staff would start arriving, and his presence in the office earlier than any of the team, in a country where showing up 2 hours early was the norm, would set the proper tone. The first man arrived only 10 minutes later, hung up his coat, and headed to the far corner to start the coffee. Not tea, both men thought at the same time. Surprisingly Western. The others arrived in a bunch, both resentful and envious of their colleague because they all noticed that the chief's office was lit and occupied. A few exercised at their work tables, both to loosen themselves up and to show their devotion. At start time minus 2 hours, the chief walked out of his office and called for his team to gather around for the first morning's talk about what they were doing. They all knew, of course, but they had to be told anyway. It took 10 minutes, and with that done, they all went to work. And this was not at all a strange way for a war to begin. Dinner was elegant, served in the enormous high-ceiling dining room to the sound of piano, violin, and the occasional ting of crystal. The table chatter was ordinary, or so it seemed, to Jack as he sipped his dinner wine and worked his way through the main course. Sally and little Jack were doing well at school, and Kathleen would turn 2 in another month as she toddled around the house at Peregrine Cliff, the dominating and assertive apple of her father's eye and the terror of her daycare center. Robbie and Sissy, childless despite all their efforts, were surrogate aunt and uncle to the Ryan trio and took as much pride in the brood as Jack and Kathy did. There was a sadness to it, Jack thought, but those were the breaks. And he wondered if Sissy still cried about it when alone in bed, Robbie off on a job somewhere. Jack had never had a brother. Robbie was closer than a brother could ever have been, and his friend deserved better luck. And Sissy, well, she was just an angel.
I wonder how the office is doing.
Probably conjuring up a plan for the invasion of Bangladesh, Jack said, looking up and re-entering the conversation.
That was last week, Jackson said with a grin.
How do they manage without us? Kathy wondered aloud, probably worrying about a patient.
Well, concert season doesn't start for me until next month, Sissy observed.
Ryan noted, looking back down at his plate, wondering how he was going to break the news.
Jack, I know, Kathy finally said. You're not good at hiding it.
Who? She asked where you were. Robbie said from across the table.
A naval officer can't lie.
Did you think I'd be mad? Kathy asked her husband.
Yes.
You don't know what he's like, Kathy told the others. Every morning gets his paper and grumbles. Every night catches the news and grumbles. every Sunday, watches the interview shows, and grumbles. Jack, she said quietly, do you think I could ever stop doing surgery?
Probably not, but it's not the same.
No, it's not, but it's the same for you.
When do you start? Carolyn Ryan asked.
Chapter 1. Alumni.
There was a university somewhere in the Midwest, Jack had once heard on the radio, which had an instrument package designed to go inside a tornado. Each spring, graduate students and a professor or two staked out a likely swath of land, and on spotting a tornado, tried to set the instrument package called Toto, what else, directly in the path of the onrushing storm. So far they had been unsuccessful. Perhaps they'd just picked the wrong place, Ryan thought, looking out the window to the leafless trees in Lafayette Park. The office of the President's National Security Advisor was surely cyclonic enough for anyone's taste, and, unfortunately, much easier for people to enter.
You know, Ryan said, leaning back in his chair, it was supposed to be a lot simpler than this, and I thought it would be, he didn't add.
The world had rules before, Scott Adler pointed out. Now it doesn't.
How's the president been doing, Scott?
You really want the truth? Adler asked, meaning we're in the White House, remember, and wondering if there really were tape machines covering this room.
We screwed up the Korean situation, but we lucked out. Thank God we didn't screw up Yugoslavia that badly, because there just isn't any luck to be had in that place.
We haven't been handling Russia very well. The whole continent of Africa's a dog's breakfast. About the only thing we've done right lately was the trade treaty.
And that doesn't include Japan and China, Ryan finished for him.
Hey, you and I fixed the Middle East, remember? That's working out fairly nicely.
Hottest spot right now?
Ryan didn't want praise for that. The success had developed some very adverse consequences and was the prime reason he'd left government service.
Take your pick, Adler suggested. Ryan grunted agreement.
Sextate?
Hansen?
Politician, replied the career Foreign Service officer. And a proud one at that, Jack reminded himself.
Adler had started off at State right after graduating number one in his Fletcher School class, then worked his way up the career ladder through all the drudgery and internal politics that had together claimed his first wife's love and a good deal of his hair. It had to be love of country that kept him going, Jack knew. The son of an Auschwitz survivor, Adler cared about America in a way that few could duplicate.
Better still, his love was not blind, even now that his current position was political and not a career rank. Like Ryan, he served at the pleasure of the president, and still he'd had the character to answer Jack's questions honestly.
Worse than that, Ryan went on for him. He's a lawyer. They always get in the way.
The usual prejudice, Adler observed with a smile, then applied some of his own analytical ability.
You have something running, don't you?
Ryan nodded.
A score to settle.
I have two good guys on it now.
The task combined oil drilling and mining to be followed by exquisitely fine finishing work, and it had to be performed on time. The rough holes were almost complete, and it had not been easy, drilling straight down into the basaltic living rock on the valley even one time, much less 10, each one of the holes fully 40 meters deep and 10 across. A crew of 900 men working in 3 rotating shifts had actually beaten the official schedule by 2 weeks, despite the precautions.
6 kilometers of rail had been laid from the nearest Shinkansen line, and for every inch of it, the catenary towers normally erected to carry the overhead electrical lines instead were the supports for 4 linear miles of camouflage netting. The geological history of this Japanese valley must have been interesting, the construction superintendent thought. You didn't see the sun until an hour or more after it rose. The slope was so steep to the east.
No wonder that previous railway engineers had looked at the valley and decided to build elsewhere. The narrow gorge, in places not even 10 meters across at its base, had been cut by a river long since dammed, and what remained was essentially a rock trench, like something left over from a war. Or in preparation for one, he thought. It was pretty obvious, after all, despite the fact that he'd never been told anything but to keep his mouth shut about the whole project. The only way out of this place was straight up or sideways. A helicopter could do the former, and a train could do the latter. But to accomplish anything else required tampering with the laws of ballistics, which was a very difficult task indeed. As he watched, a huge Kawa scoop loader dumped another bucket load of crushed rock into a hopper car. It was the last car in the train's consist, and soon the diesel switch engine would haul its collection of cars out to the main line, where a standard-gauge electric locomotive would take over. "Finished," the man told him, pointing down into the hole. At the bottom, a man held the end of a long tape measure, 40 meters exactly. The hole had been measured by laser already, of course, but tradition required that such measurements be tested by the human hand of a skilled worker. And there at the bottom was a middle-aged hard rock miner whose face beamed with pride, and who had no idea what this project was all about. "Hi," the superintendent said with a pleased nod, and then a more formal, gracious bow to the man at the bottom, which was dutifully and proudly returned. The next train in would carry an oversized cement mixer. The pre-assembled sets of rebar were already stacked around this hole, and indeed all the others ready to be lowered. In finishing the first hole, this team had beaten its nearest competitor by perhaps 6 hours, and its furthest by no more than 2 days. Irregularities in the subsurface rock had been a problem for hole number 6, and in truth they'd done well to catch up as closely as they were now. He'd have to speak to them, congratulate them for their Herculean effort, so as to mitigate their shame at being last. Team 6 was his best crew, and it was a pity that they'd been unlucky. 3 more months, we will make the deadline, the site foreman said confidently. When 6 is also finished, we will have a party for the men. They have earned it. This isn't much fun, Chavez observed. Warm, too, Clark agreed. The air conditioning system on their Range Rover was broken, or perhaps it had died of despair. Fortunately, they had lots of bottled water. But it's a dry heat, Ding replied, as though it mattered at 114 degrees. One could think in Celsius instead, but that offered relief only as long as it took to take in another breath. Then you were reminded of the abuse that the superheated air had to be doing to your lungs, no matter how you kept score. He unscrewed the cap from a plastic bottle of spring water, which was probably a frigid 95, he estimated. Amazing how cool it tasted under the circumstances. Chill down tonight all the way to 80, maybe. Good thing I brought my sweater, Mr. C. Chavez paused to wipe off some sweat before looking through the binoculars again. They were good ones, but they didn't help much except to give a better view of the shimmering air that roiled like the surface of a stormy, invisible sea. Nothing lived out here except for the occasional vulture, and surely by now they had cleaned off the carcasses of everything that had once made the mistake of being born out here. And he'd once thought the Mojave Desert was bleak, Chavez told himself. At least coyotes lived there. It never changed, Clark thought. He'd been doing jobs like this one for 30 years. Not quite, but close. Jesus, 30 years. He still hadn't had the chance to do it in a place where he could really fit in, but that didn't seem terribly important right now. Their cover was wearing thin. The back of the rover was jammed with surveying equipment and boxes of rock samples, enough to persuade the local illiterates that there might be an enormous molybdenum deposit out there in that solitary mountain. The locals knew what gold looked like. Who didn't? but the mineral known affectionately to miners as Molly Be Damned was a mystery to the uninitiated in all but its market value, which was considerable. Clark had used the ploy often enough. A geological discovery offered people just the perfect sort of luck to appeal to their invariable greed. They just loved the idea of having something valuable sitting under their feet, and John Clark looked the part of a mining engineer with his rough and honest face to deliver the good and very confidential news. He checked his watch. The appointment was in 90 minutes around sunset, and he'd shown up early, the better to check out the area. It was hot and empty, neither of which came as much of a surprise, and was located 20 miles from the mountain they would be talking about briefly. There was a crossroads here, two tracks of beaten dirt, one mainly north-south, the other mainly east-west, both of which somehow remained visible despite the blowing sand and grit that ought to have covered up all traces of human presence. Clark didn't understand it. The years-long drought couldn't have helped, but even with occasional rain he had to wonder how the hell anyone had lived here. Yet some people had, and for all he knew still did when there was grass for their goats to eat, and no men with guns to steal the goats and kill the herdsmen. Mainly the two CIA field officers sat in their car with the windows open, drank their bottled water, and sweated after they ran out of words to exchange. The trucks showed up close to dusk. They saw the dust plumes first, like the rooster tails of motorboats, yellow in the diminishing light. In such an empty, desperate country, how was it possible that they knew how to make trucks run? Somebody knew how to keep them running, and that seemed very remarkable. Perversely, it meant that all was not lost for this desolate place. If bad men could do it, then good men could do it as well, and that was the reason for Clark and Chavez to be there, wasn't it? The first truck was well in advance of the others. It was old, probably a military truck originally, though with all the body damage, the country of origin and the name of the manufacturer were matters of speculation. It circled their rover at a radius of about 100 meters while the eyes of the crew checked them out at a discreet, careful distance, including one man on what looked like a Russian 12.7-millimeter machine gun mounted in the back. Policemen, their boss called them. Once it was technicals. After a while they stopped, got out, and just stood there watching the rover, holding their old, dirty, but probably functional G3 rifles. The men would soon be less important. It was evening, after all, and the CAC was out. Chavez watched a man sitting in the shade of his truck 100 meters away, chewing on the weed. "Can't the dumb sons of bitches at least smoke it?" the exasperated field officer asked the burning air in the car. "Bad for the lungs, ding, you know that." Their appointment for the evening made quite a living for himself by flying it in. In fact, roughly 2/5 of the country's gross domestic product went into that trade, supporting a small fleet of aircraft that flew it in from Somalia. The fact offended both Clark and Chavez, but their mission wasn't about personal offense. It was about a long-standing debt. General Mohammed Abdul Corp, his rank had largely been awarded by reporters who didn't know what else to call him, had once upon a time been responsible for the deaths of 20 American soldiers. 2 years ago, to be exact, far beyond the memory horizon of the media, because after he'd killed the American soldiers, he'd gone back to his main business of killing his own countrymen. It was for the latter cause that Clark and Chavez were nominally in the field, but justice had many shapes and many colors, and it pleased Clark to pursue a parallel agenda. That Corp was also a dealer in narcotics seemed a special gift from a good-humored god. "Wash up before he gets here?" Ding asked, tenser now and showing it just a little bit. All four men by the trucks just sat there chewing their cac and staring, their rifles lying across their legs, the heavy machine gun on the back of their truck forgotten now. They were the forward security element, such as it was, for their general. Clark shook his head. Waste of time. Shit, we've been here 6 weeks. All for one appointment. Well, that was how it worked, wasn't it? I needed to sweat off the 5 pounds, Clark replied with a tense smile of his own. Probably more than 5, he figured. These things take time to do right. I wonder how Patsy is doing in college, Ding murmured as the next collection of dust plumes grew closer. Clark didn't respond. It was distantly unseemly that his daughter found his field partner exotic and interesting, and charming, Clark admitted to himself. Though Ding was actually shorter than his daughter, Patsy took after her tall and rangy mom, and possessed of a decidedly checkered background, John had to allow for the fact that Chavez had worked as hard as any man he'd ever known to make himself into something that fate had tried very hard to deny him. The lad was 31 now. Lad? Clark asked himself. 10 years older than his little girl, Patricia Doris Clark. He could have said something about how they lived a rather crummy life in the field, but Ding would have replied that it was not his decision to make, and it wasn't. Sandy hadn't thought so either. What Clark couldn't shake was the idea that his Patricia, his baby, might be sexually active with Ding. The father part of him found the idea disturbing, but the rest of him had to admit that he'd had his own youth once. Daughters, he told himself, were God's revenge on you for being a man. You lived in mortal fear that they might accidentally encounter somebody like yourself at that age. In Patsy's case, the similarity in question was just too striking to accept easily. Concentrate on the mission, Ding. Roger that, Mr. C. Clark didn't have to turn his head. He could see the smile that had to be poised on his partner's face. He could almost feel it evaporate, too, as more dust plumes appeared through the shimmering air. "We're gonna get you, motherfucker," Ding breathed, back to business and wearing his mission face again. It wasn't just the dead American soldiers. People like Corp destroyed everything they touched, and this part of the world needed a chance at a future. That chance might have come 2 years earlier if the president had listened to his field commanders instead of the UN. Well, at least he seemed to be learning, which wasn't bad for a president. The sun was lower, almost gone now, and the temperature was abating. More trucks, not too many more, they both hoped. Chavez shifted his eyes to the 4 men 100 yards away. They were talking back and forth with a little animation, mellow from the CAC. Ordinarily it would be dangerous to be around drug-sotted men carrying military weapons, but tonight danger was inverting itself as it sometimes did. The second truck was clearly visible now, and it came up close. Both CIA officers got out of their vehicle to stretch, then to greet the new visitors, cautiously, of course. The general's personal guard force of elite policemen was no better than the ones who'd arrived before, although some of this group did wear unbuttoned shirts. The first one to come up to them smelled of whiskey, probably pilfered from the general's private stock. That was an affront to Islam, but then so was trafficking in drugs. One of the things Clark admired about the Saudis was their direct and peremptory method for processing that category of criminal. "Hi," Clark smiled at the man. "I'm John Clark. This is Mr. Chavez. We've been waiting for the general like you told us." "What you carry?" the policeman asked, surprising Clark with his knowledge of English. John held up his bag of rock samples while Ding showed his pair of electronic instruments. After a cursory inspection of the vehicle, they were spared even a serious frisking, a pleasant surprise. Corp arrived next with his most reliable security force, if you could call it that. They rode in a Russian Zill-type jeep. The general was actually in a Mercedes that had once belonged to a government bureaucrat before the government of this country had disintegrated. It had seen better times, but was still the best automobile in the country, probably. Corp wore his Sunday best, a khaki shirt outside the whipcord trousers with something supposed to be rank insignia on the epaulettes.
and boots that had been polished sometime in the last week. The sun was just under the horizon now. Darkness would fall quickly, and the thin atmosphere of the high desert made for lots of visible stars even now. The general was a gracious man, at least by his own lights. He walked over briskly, extending his hand. As he took it, Clark wondered what had become of the owner of the Mercedes, most likely murdered along with the other members of the government. They died partly of incompetence, but mostly of barbarism, probably at the hands of the man whose firm and friendly hand he was now shaking. "Have you completed your survey?" Corp asked, surprising Clark again with his grammar. "Yes, sir, we have. May I show you?"
"Certainly."
Corp followed him to the back of the rover. Chavez pulled out a survey map and some satellite photos obtained from commercial sources. "This may be the biggest deposit since the one in Colorado, and the purity is surprising. Right here." Clark extended a steel pointer and tapped it on the map. 30 kilometers from where we are sitting." Clark smiled. "You know, as long as I've been in this business, it still surprises me how this happens. A couple of billion years ago, a huge bubble of the stuff must have just perked up from the center of the earth." His lecture was lyrical. He'd had lots of practice, and it helped that Clark read books on geology for recreation, borrowing the nicer phrases for his pitch. "Anyway," Ding said, taking his cue a few minutes later, "the overburden is no problem at all, and we have the location fixed perfectly."
"How can you do that?" Corp asked.
His country's maps were products of another and far more casual age.
"With this, sir," Ding handed it over. "What is it?" the general asked.
"A GPS locator," Chavez explained. "It's how we find our way around, sir. You just push that button there, the rubber one." Corp did just that, then held the large, thin, green plastic box up and watched the readout. First it gave him the exact time, then started to make its fix, showing that it had lock with 1, then 3, and finally 4 orbiting Global Positioning System satellites.
"Such an amazing device," he said,
though that wasn't the half of it. By pushing the button, he had also sent out a radio signal. It was so easy to forget that they were scarcely 100 miles from the Indian Ocean, and that beyond the visible horizon might be a ship with a flat deck. A large, empty deck at the moment, because the helicopters that lived there had lifted off an hour earlier and were now sitting at a secure site 35 miles to the south. Corp took one more look at the GPS locator before handing it back.
"What is that rattle?" he asked as Ding took it.
"Battery pack is loose, sir," Chavez explained with a smile. It was their only handgun and not a large one. The general ignored the irrelevancy and turned back to Clark.
"How much?" he asked simply.
"Well, determining the exact size of the deposit will require
money, Mr. Clark."
"Anaconda's prepared to offer you $50 million, sir. We'll pay that in 4 payments of $12.5 million plus 10% of the gross profits from the mining operations. The advance fee and the continuing income will be paid in U.S. dollars."
"More than that, I know what molybdenum is worth."
He checked a copy of the Financial Times on the way in. "But it will take 2 years, closer to 3 probably, to commence operations. Then we have to determine the best way to get the ore to the coast, probably truck, maybe a rail line if the deposit is as big as I think it is. Our upfront costs to develop the operation will be on the order of $300 million. Even with the labor costs here, Clark didn't have to add.
"I need more money to keep my people happy. You must understand that," Corp said reasonably.
Had he been an honorable man, Clark thought, this could have been an interesting negotiation. Corp wanted the additional upfront money to buy arms in order to reconquer the country that he had once almost owned. The UN had displaced him, but not quite thoroughly enough. Relegated to dangerous obscurity in the bush, he had survived the last year by running cack into the cities, such as they were, and he'd made enough from the trade that some thought him to be a danger to the state again, such as it was. With new arms, of course, and control over the country, he would then renegotiate the continuing royalty for the molybdenum. It was a clever ploy, Clark thought.